kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to episode number 62 of Today in Digital Education, Tide, the Tide podcast, which is by me, Di Barnes, and...
me, Doug Belshaw. Di, this is the first episode when we're going to go back to a conversation that we didn't just have last week, but a conversation we had like almost 25 episodes ago.
25 episodes ago? My gosh, we're really going to do that.
23, but yes, it's a while ago.
It is a long time. Mm-hmm. Nearly half a lifetime ago, or Tide's lifetime ago. Well, cool, that'll be interesting. Why are we going to go back there?
Well, I as you know, I've got lots of different places to blog, just because I don't know actually why that is. I was thinking about that the other day. Anyway, it doesn't matter. One of them is powered by a network which was launched about the same time as Medium, called Subtle. It's SVBTLE.
I know it, yes. Yeah.
And so when you log into that, the way that the dashboard works is that you kind of saved, a bit like on WordPress and stuff, you're going to save kind of partial posts, but the way that they structure it is if it's like a brain and you can see things. And one of the things I'd written down after episode 39, algorithmic ad blockers, was something that you'd said. And you'd said something about curriculum as algorithm, which is the title we've given to this podcast. And I just want to dig into that. And I wrote a short piece this week crediting you and just kind of digging into that metaphor. And I feel like it's something which we can unpack here, and also people listening might want to think through further, because when I did a quick search, there's lots of results for if you put curriculum and algorithm in, but it's teaching the concept of algorithm within the curriculum rather than the curriculum being an algorithm. So after we've just had a quick discussion as an introduction, we'll dive into that as our main topic.
Cool. Sounds good. Sounds interesting.
Mm. So what have you been up to this week?
Right, so this week has been what? So we had a thing called Field Weekend this weekend. So 250 of our pupils are rocked off to the Somme for the 100-year anniversary. And that was a big trip. 40 teachers went along with them, and they all trawled over in minibuses and hired vehicles and such like. Wow. And had a great time, as far as I know, very moving time. That's all good. But I stayed here with my digital leaders. And so I had them on for all of Sunday and Monday. And we were doing little projects on, so we're doing like proofs of concept, really. So one team are working on taking the debating work that we do here. So we enter national debating competitions galore. And, so we're putting that all online, and then they're going to record the audio of the debate. So they were doing proof of concept of that and testing the kit that we're going to use to record it, make sure it's good enough quality and the workflow and everything, which was really cool. And they built websites using GitHub, which was cool. Then we had a proof of concept of recording sports fixtures. So you get these tripods that you can buy with cameras on the top for about $3,000 plus VAT, or a bit more maybe. And it's a remote control, wireless remote control, which will do the camera so you can zoom in on the action and someone records it. And then looking at using Dartfish for sports analysis. So I've been talking to a guy called Sebastian in Switzerland.
Sorry, what's Dartfish?
It's a sports analysis software. So it's a bit like what you'd see one of the football commentators using to draw lines on the screen and that kind of thing.
Oh, interesting. Because when I'm going to mention this in a moment, but I was over at Victoria College in Jersey last Thursday and Friday. And when I was talking to the kids, they said that the department which used technology best was PE. And they were doing exactly that. So they're probably using, was it like an iPad app or?
So I've been finding this out in detail while having the pupils research it. And look at the sort of different parameters and the workflow that would be required on the day of the match and to get it analyzed in post-production. And so Dartfish sets up with a piece of desktop software, but you have to go through the match and tag different bits of play so that it can basically index the play, if you like, from different positions and different pieces and such like. But if you've got someone on the side of the pitch using the iPad app, it will tag it live as the game is played. So as long as the person is discerning and making the right decisions, then, you know, you just say you're doing rugby, you tag every line out, tag every maul, tag every scrum, etc., penalty kick, whatever. And then the app syncs with the desktop and tags the footage. that was recorded along with that. So that looks quite cool, but it's not cheap either. So they're moving towards subscription, a yearly subscription license. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at having 5 licenses. And then you have to look at, so schools that have visited us have different contraptions. So one school just paid a company to record the match and analyze it. Another school had their own recording kit, so they would record it, but then they'd send the footage away and have that analyzed by a company. Mm. And we're looking at doing it all in-house. So I kind of want to get a team of pupils together who will execute, implement whatever the analysis, and as well as do the recording, but different people doing it, because obviously they're having to give up their time to do it. Mm. So we're looking at putting the systems in place to get that done.
Interesting. I think this particular one was just the iPad app, and it was based on individual technique on things like, you know, you could draw on the video when someone was throwing the javelin and do slow mo and show that your knees out of place or whatever.
That's just if you get the iPad app, and that's $500. It was Fiverr on the iPad. It's only a Fiverr actually.
Really?
It's different. Yeah, and they ramp it up. So their top level packages, I think for 5 sets of the apps together came to $3,000 a year or something like that. So, or $2,000 a year. It wasn't cheap, but that's for 4-5 different installations. So. Mm-hmm.
And just while you're talking about, before I forget it, when you mentioned doing websites with GitHub, Tim Jeffers, hi Tim, said today on Twitter, he said that he was looking to pull all of his school policies into that thing that I'd mentioned at some point. And I don't know if I mentioned on a podcast or on Twitter or whatever, but have we talked about Gitbook?
No, we haven't. What is it? I'm just looking.
Gitbook is a way of using GitHub to do, well, either collaborative books or however you want to do. Basically, it has all of the functionality of GitHub, but it's in book form. Now, what he shared with me, and I'll have to go back through my tweets to find this, was all of his school's policies on a Google Doc spreadsheet. And then they were hyperlinked to the Google Doc of that policy itself. And then on each column, it had things like, is this statutory? Who, you know, the initials of the person who looked after the policy, when it was last edited, when it was last revised, all that kind of stuff. And I thought that's already a pretty good start. And his idea was to put it on Gitbook so that it was a nicer front end and everything was together and in chapters and all that kind of stuff, which I thought was a great idea.
Yeah, no, it does seem. I mean, I have to say that every school handbook I've ever come across has been substandard, just because they're so difficult to negotiate. Mm. And
well, I think this is pathway towards a wiki, and I think possibly if you can get a nice enough, you know, if you can get a kind of what you see is what you get style wiki editor, and you spend time building a culture around how, you know, wiki, the way of the wiki, as it were. I think wikis work better than anything. There's a book, someone mentioned this actually, during the Creative Commons Thinkathon that we did, and there was a book way, way back, like 2005, by someone called Stuart Mader, and he wrote a book called Wiki Patterns, and that book was great because it showed that, you know, we often talk about it's not the technology which is the problem when you're doing anything to do with change management. Usually, it's usually the human factor. And in this book, from what I remember, because I think I reviewed it while it was still in draft or something, he talks about like wiki fairies and wiki gardeners and people having different roles depending on their talents and their interests, and, you know, people playing different roles within the community and everything like that. And that seemed like a good thing to do. Anytime when you've got the onus of policies or development sitting on one person's head, it always seems to fall over.
Yes, I think that's the case. I mean, it's a difficult move, and good luck, Tim, with what you're doing. And this looks like an interesting interesting development and a way to do it, if you're happy to have all your stuff open and online and all of that. It's a good idea, I think.
Yep. So, yeah, for those interested, Gitbook, there's ways in which you can do this for free if you know your way around GitHub and custom domains and things, but other than that, if you just want to do the standard thing and do all the default options of Gitbook, if you make it entirely public, then it's free. Or if you want to make it private, either while you're developing it or private and give people access, a bit like Google Docs, then you can do that, and it's a certain number of dollars per month, I think.
Cool. Right, so other digital leader projects that were going on, let me think, were green screen proof of concept. So I want to do this thing where we're taking these slow-mo science experiments and then I want to zap children into them via the green screen so they can, pause the experiment or the video and they explain what's going on, being the size of the experiment, if you see what I mean, being the same size actually in it. And
but like inside the beach?
Kind, sort of, yeah, inside the video shot.
Like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, that's it. So, and green screen, I've been doing green screen for years. I'm sure lots of people have who are listening. But in every organization you go into, you have to get the kit in and then get a green screen wall in and all of that. So, we're just doing proof of concept and making sure. So the idea of this is that what I'm really trying to do is give the digital leaders the expertise or make them acquire the expertise. I'm certainly not teaching them. They have to go and work it out for themselves with only mild guidance from myself. And so that was that. They did that. That was really, really funny. They did dabbing. Do you know what dabbing is?
Oh, my son doesn't stop dabbing, seriously.
Right. So they did dabbing for their green screen.
Where does that even come from? I don't get it. It feels like some kind of vaguely Nazi salute.
No, I don't think it's that. I was curious about this as well because the reason I looked it up was because I thought, is this an insult or is it not? Mm. I can't work it out. And effectively what it is, it's like falling asleep on your arm. So does my face look bothered or talk to my hand or whatever? It's a bit like that. So the idea of dabbing. So for example, if you did something that was really like you scored a try in rugby and you went and did a dab afterwards,
I could do this in my sleep kind of thing.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Does this bother
me? The other thing, I was sitting on a bus in Jersey. This shows how old I'm getting, right? And I've never really got Snapchat. I've got a Snapchat account, but I've got no way to Snapchat, so... and then there were a couple of girls in front of me. I looked up, and she was opening a message, and there was a kid trying to spin a bottle to try and, stand it up on its end after flicking it round.
All right,
and, yeah. And apparently it's totally a thing at the minute. Everyone's doing it. Everyone's doing my son's school and things as well. And she turned to her friend and said, yeah, he's been sending me snaps of that all day. He hasn't done one yet. And I know I used to do pointless things as a teenager, but oh my days.
I'm going to do it. I'm on it now. I'm going to be, every day I'm going to spin the bottle and see where it lands.
Well, my son and I have just done it, and the trick is to fill the bottle half full. I managed to do it, and then he did it as well, so it's not that hard.
No, not once you've worked out to fill the bottle. True.
Have you seen, talking about Snapchat, do you see that they've announced those sunglasses?
No, what?
Have you not? Oh, let me find the link for this. So they've announced sunglasses with a built-in camera. So it's like Google Glass, but they're only going to be like $100.
Oh, okay, because they're just doing the camera thing rather than...
And you can record 10 seconds of video. And the sun, I've just Googled this and it says, the sun have called them surveillance sunglasses. But of course they're not. They're like a toy, basically.
Yeah, that does surveillance, though. I mean, that's the deal.
Well, yeah, but the whole point is, like, the video, which I've seen, I'll put the BBC link in here. The point is that you just record, it's got, on the video, they've got, like, a load of kids on skateboards, and they're just, having a quick snap of what they're doing at the time, like, as if they're, like, first-person view.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and what's the problem with that? It's the deal with all of these things. So something comes along and you can use it for something else and someone tries and get salacious headlines. Oh, speaking of salacious headlines, did you see the one that happened just before we started recording?
Nope.
Sam Allardyce has stepped down as England manager.
Oh, I saw... So my wife said that he'd... people have called him like Scam Allardyce and things.
Yeah, yeah, because he's worked out a way and he was caught... trapped, as it were, by a journalist in exposing how he bypassed the rules for the transfer market in the FA. Yeah. Anyway, so he's gone.
Anyway, hopefully go back to Sunderland, get rid of Moyes. The Snapchat sunglasses. So a perfect example of... There's nothing wrong with having a camera in the sunglasses that you can see and you can see when it's recording, yeah?
Yeah.
That is a lot less privacy invading than your phone, which tracks exactly where you go all the time. So this week, it's been revealed that Instagram pretty much track you everywhere all of the time, and it's almost impossible to delete where you are. So, we've talked about geofencing with Yik Yak and Flickr before.
Yeah, yeah.
So for those listening, geofencing is where you draw a line around the area where you live, and what it does is it doesn't give you the exact location. You know, when you take a photograph, it shows the exactly where you were standing. It will not show you the exact location within that area. It'll just say that the photograph was taken somewhere within, like, Morpeth, where I live, or even Northumberland, or whatever it is it's going to be.
Yeah.
And so Instagram doesn't do that. It doesn't have a geofencing thing. So I think it was Alan Levine said that he went to the far end of everything to try and make sure that he takes a lot of photographs at home, and it wasn't just when he took them on his iPhone, it was when his DSLR was connected to his phone in some way, and it was very easy to pinpoint his house, even though he's very privacy aware.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I know DSLR photographs have a ridiculous amount of metadata in the background. And if you ever go and look at the, I forgot what it's called now, but I teach this to GCSE classes, and just go and open up the data in the back, you start to see the amount of detail that the SLR is ready to capture. Whether you've set it to capture it or not, it's a different matter. There we go.
Well, this is the thing. This is how people get caught when they, Anyway. I was in Jersey flew last Wednesday. Awkward with flights, you know, at the moment. Thursday, Friday, and I couldn't fly back till Saturday. Stayed in... was a cheap hotel, realised why it was so cheap. I lowered the average age by about 40 years. you couldn't have breakfast until 8:30 kind of thing.
Really? My word.
Yeah, so I had to especially to have breakfast at 7. Got a taxi across the island. It must have been about 5 miles, cost me 40 quid. You know,
you're joking.
No, seriously.
Uber's not yet come to Jersey, I guess.
So I got the bus the next day, and it was £2. And I got to sit on the top deck and look over the very rich people's gardens and see in over their big fences. It's a very stratified society on that very small island, I would say. No newspapers like The Guardian or The Independent, all just the Murdoch right-wing press.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did notice that, unless I wasn't looking in the right places. But having said that, it's a lovely place. Everyone at Victoria College was fantastic, very much up for change, extremely pleasant, very welcoming, and yeah, hopefully I'm going to be doing some more work there. But I was just asking questions about digital strategy, doing some training on Google Classroom, finding out, you know, where the edges are of the things that they wanted to do. They haven't got a head of digital strategy at the moment, and so I'm kind of going over to help out until they can recruit one, hopefully in September 2017.
It's nice that the school's nice. How is it with Google Classroom then? What do you think?
So I need to... I was talking about this on Slack today, wasn't I? So mm-hmm. I feel like I need to write something about... because you gave me a guided tour of Google Classroom before I got my login for Victoria College, which is very kind of you. Thank you. And it is pretty straightforward. And it's almost deceptively simple to use. But certainly during the training... these weren't teachers who were trying to push the boundaries. It became clear that it's meant for a certain type of interaction. So the training went fine, and you know, I can teach Google tools standing in my head. But for example, they wanted to... you can set up so you can team teach, as you know. So you know, you and I could be teaching a class, and we could both put things in there. You could almost like delegate certain students to kind of do that kind of thing as well. But what you can't do is, for example, have three classes in one stream and then separate out things depending on which teacher is doing what. So you can't have like inter-class discussions and that kind of thing. You'd have to use a different platform for that. So I feel like it's pretty basic, and it almost perpetuates a very... although it looks cool and everything, like it perpetuates a certain style of teaching.
I think it's interesting what you say, and Part of me wants to explore that more, and part of me wants to push back on what you said. So I'm push back. So from my point of view, I don't really want a monolithic system that rules it all.
No.
Do you know what I mean? So I don't, but I do want a core communications vehicle to have with my classes, and I want that to be more or less in one place sort of thing in its core, but I want to be able to bring in other services to connect to that, and and work it through. So I don't really object to the things that you're objecting to possibly, or you're raising as possible issues for Google Classroom. And I would be kind of a bit wary if Google started developing the product in that manner. So they're just keeping it very simple. And I kind of like tech that is that does its job and does its job well and focuses on making that job a good thing.
Hmm. So I agree. And I have to say, I'd rather use Google Classroom from what I've seen than any other. I mean, it doesn't really qualify as an LMS or a VLE. Well, it's not that kind of thing. I very much like the fact that you can do the same thing in different ways using Google Apps. So, you know, you can do a very simple quiz or poll in Google Classroom, but you could also make a much more powerful one using Google Forms. I kind of like that. I think that's a good idea. But at the same time, I feel like it presents itself as a neutral tool. And because I haven't written about this, I kind of haven't really thought it through much, but I've just got this underlying feeling that there have been design decisions made, not necessarily by educators.
Well, I think that's true. So my awareness, so when I was a mentor at Google Teacher Academy in London in the end of 2014, the product leader for Classroom was on a hangout in the room with all of the sort of 60 people that were there. And so she said this really interesting thing, which was, so a big request was that you could add another teacher to Google Classroom, to a classroom. You could have a second teacher or a third teacher because people shared classes.
Hmm.
And, which is a kind of good idea. And, but Google, and she said, well, if we did that, we would have to completely rewrite Classroom from the ground up because of the way that it's put together, the way it's
coded. But they've done that now, haven't they?
But they've done that, yeah. So they did take it and they did rewrite it.
That kind of resistance that you saw even just there shows which way, you know, whether the pedagogy is leading the technology or the technology leading the pedagogy. Now, in the end, things have worked out okay, but...
Well, in that instance, I
have. In that instance, but it's still expanding the teacher bubble rather than the student bubble. What I do like is the fact that by default, I'm not sure if this is an admin setting, but certainly on the Victoria College one, the default setting was that students could post to the stream and comment.
As far as I'm aware, that's not an admin setting, and it is the default. And you can mute a pupil, and they will not be allowed to contribute to any of the conversations in your classroom anymore.
Okay.
And not just the one post, but the whole. Shooting match, if you see what I mean. But pupils can post announcements to the classroom of their own volition. And I'm always trying to encourage my pupils to do that. You know, if they find something good, to share it. If they've spent some time. So one person shared with me a Mozilla podcast, actually, about Have We Ruined the Internet, I think it was called. I haven't listened to it yet, but they shared it. So they said, I've just listened to this. So stick it in there. And then others might listen to it, or at least see that other people in the class are making an effort to consume technology news in a different way and not on the curriculum as such. Well, it's kind of good. But so I think there's lots of potential for what you could do with Classroom, and I imagine Google will keep developing it. So just in the summer, for example, they have made inking possible if you're marking a pupil's work. So so if you're using the app on your phone or on a tablet. And on Android, on the Android device, sorry, on the Chrome devices, the Chromebooks that are going to allow Android apps to be used, you're going to be able to ink on those on that work, and which is quite an important thing because it's a very easy way for a teacher to highlight things, and it is it just PDF snapshots whatever document it is that the pupil has shared, and then you just
annotate. This isn't really a fault of Google Classroom per se, but it is perpetuating. It's just digitizing offline practice.
It is, but inking's a big deal. I mean, we've discussed this before. So in the teachers that I've talked to, not so much in my life, because I work on computers all of the time, and the pupils I work with have computers all of the time, and they always have.
Hmm.
So my classroom practice is different to other teachers. I'm always quite aware of that. Anything that helps. So, for example, mathematics teachers, I've worked with many, many, many of them over the years, and not one of them is interested in anything that can't be a piece of paper and a pencil and now it can be.
No, I don't doubt that it's important. What I'm saying is that it's when things which are use the Samir thing or not, but things which are substitutionary are seen as like major features rather than taken for granted features.
Yes. Well, I think, I mean, well, this is one of the things, you see. So as technology emerges, evolves, then it's, you get that idea that people think, well, I would do this, but it can't do that. And why can't it do that? I don't understand. I don't really get it. Why, you know, and this is one of the things that it should have been able to do for years. And now it can do because, touchscreens have moved on. And it's actually quite possible for everyone to be able to do this now. The other good thing about it is I think, and I haven't tested this yet, but I think it works the other way around as well. So if you send a document to the pupils, they can write on it. They can ink on the document that you send to them, as well as you being asked to.
And I mean, I need to go away and think about this. And because you've been using Google Classroom for ages, and I've really only been using it for the last week and a bit, and I need to go away and think about what I'm trying to say here. But it feels like even, like it's a great ability to be able to do what you showed me, which is take a document or Google Doc and press one button and send it to, you know, 14 different copies or 28 different copies to 28 different kids, and then they work on their own copies, and then you kind of get them all back in. That's great, and that's a huge time saver. But it's an efficiency saving rather than there's an element of pedagogy there, but it's not really. It's more of an efficiency kind of thing, because you could go through and make 28 different things. But the thing which I feel like is missing is the default collaboration between students and also the power dynamic within the classroom. Now, no technology company is going to make something which explicitly challenges the power dynamic within the classroom, because no one would buy into their tools. So I'm asking for a ridiculous thing. So I'm going to pause this discussion, if you don't mind, and go away and have a think and write about it. Or perhaps
I had something like this today. So I started a controlled assessment with my fifth form year 11s today. And so we were just looking at the thing. So I made a document called controlled assessment notes and invited them all to edit the one document, 15 pupils in the class. And I was quite firm about them not mucking about in it. You know, we had work to do, and it's kind of examination time sort of thing. And some of them still found it very hard to resist mucking about and just press it, just saying, "Hi, sir," because it's on the board and that kind of thing. And I got a bit annoyed about that. So I went to change the share settings, but because I'd shared the document through Classroom for them all to edit, I can't alter the share settings of one pupil within that document. Because it shares to a classroom.
It's like a proxy of
Yeah, exactly. Like a group thing, a bit like Google Groups, really. And so that's quite interesting. So I have to either turn the whole class off as editors, or just deal with it and deal with the individuals concerned, which is what I'm going to do. But that sort of lends itself to what you're saying, is that if I wanted to set up a document for three or four of them, I'd have to go either into Google Docs or another platform and do that manually. But again, I reiterate that is okay by me.
Yeah, and a lot of this, I think, comes down to your own digital capability as a teacher, but also something to do with your kind of personality and teaching style. So, you know, some people are a bit more formal in their teaching, and some people are very relaxed. And I've seen amazing teachers with both ends of the spectrum. So some of it is just literally how you decide to run your classroom.
A lot of it's about that, isn't it, I think? You know, I think a lot of teaching comes down to that. It's about the individual teacher and the nuances that they create, the environment they create, and the way they interact with the children, and the way they encourage different kinds of work to go on in their classroom, or they want it to be the rigid, is that the right word? Brittle, maybe, structures that they can't, they don't like to be broken, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes, though, and, you know, I'm not teaching at the moment, but sometimes it feels to me like different classes, just because the mixture of personalities you've got in there, you have to treat them in a certain way. Like, they need more structure than other classes, or they need the firmness, or whatever it is. And Yeah. Anyway, let's not go down that road. Let's go on to the main topic because we are half an hour in.
Cool. Let's go. Curriculum so, as algorithm.
Yeah. So as we said in the introduction to the introduction, the main topic today is curriculum as algorithm. Now, I was going to go back through episode 39 of Tide to find the exact moment when you said curriculum as algorithm and then play that section now. But it was actually one of our longest podcasts ever, at almost 2 hours. And I've got other things to do. So you did mention curriculum as algorithm. It wasn't really a fully fleshed out thought as much as I remember. It was like you connected the discussion we were having and summed it up as this concept, which we didn't then explore in any more depth. Do you remember that differently?
Yes. No, it's exactly. Mm. It's just the sense that each person going through the curriculum effectively is experiencing similar sorts of things, and at some level the curriculum exists as an algorithm.
Right, so what I wrote this post today, and I put it on my literacies blog, and I found quite a nice graphic to go with it. This was on Flickr. And serendipitously, the chapter of the book called Lauren Ipsum, which I've mentioned on here before, which I'm reading to my 5-year-old daughter, this particular chapter was about kind of a maze or a labyrinth where she had to choose between two different paths, and there were 16 million different paths because there were 24 times when she had to make a choice between two different paths. And she goes there, and it's basically teaching branching logic to kids who are very young. And it's almost like that here in terms of the diagram. And it reminded me of skill trees. But being the kind of philosopher and perhaps only retentive person that I am, I went back to the definitions of curriculum and algorithm. And so...
Not only retentive, careful, that's all.
Well, I used the definitions on Wikipedia. Would you agree with these definitions on Wikipedia?
I was quite happy with them. It's sort of quite interesting. Algorithm particularly is more interesting because it's got this sort of wider, more complex root in it, connected to a Persian mathematician, and but then goes on as well and involves. So the full Wikipedia article talks about Turing and other computer scientists, which are quite interesting.
So let's read out those definitions. So the first one, this is from Wikipedia. Quote, in education, a curriculum is broadly defined as the totality of student experiences that occur in the educational process. The term often refers specifically to a planned sequence of instruction or to a view of the student's experiences in terms of the educator's or school's instructional goals. And then there's the etymology. And then algorithm is, quote, in mathematics and computer science, an algorithm is a self-contained step-by-step set of operations to be performed. Algorithms perform calculation, data processing, and or automated reasoning tasks, end of quote.
Yes, right. So there are our definitions. So the question is, so first of all, let's take this in its sort of simplistic format. Mm. So we know what a curriculum is, we know what an algorithm is. So a school sets up a curriculum.
Yeah.
And so I would argue that they do that in a series of levels kind of thing. And the top level, they say, right, we're going to have these subjects, and then you go to the subject specialist and they're going to design, a curriculum informed by possibly some national practice or like exams, for example, where the exam, you know, specifications from exams and the things that lead up to those at Key Stage 3, Key Stage 2, Key Stage 1, or wherever the exams exist. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to drive that to a certain extent, as well as the individual in place, as well as their sort of subject knowledge and experience. It informs them of what is going to successfully help the children learn the material required for the exam, but also a wider holistic knowledge about the role that subject plays within society.
Right.
Past, present, and future kind of thing.
And some of that is determined by the school, and some of that is foisted upon them by the Department of Education, whatever authority the school defers to.
And the joint curriculum of qualification. Yes.
So, I mean, let's just take this. I mean, the way that I've thought of this, and like I said before, the way that I tend to do my thinking is to write things out and to realize as I'm writing where the contradictions lie. So let's just see what you think of this. I said that my kind of gloss on the definitions of algorithm and curriculum were that curriculum is kind of the container for the student experiences that we want within a educational institution. So here's the edges of what it is that we're going to focus on. And that an algorithm would provide the pathways inside there. Would that seem reasonable?
I think so. So the word container has the word contain in it, which suggests something kind of non-human rather than inhumane. So human beings are kind of not good at containing sort of thing, because the student experience could be so broad and varied and unpredictable, possibly unpredictable, that that will be a difficult word. But I think what you're really describing is not that. I think you're trying to So it's difficult to say the curriculum is the container for student experience.
Maybe it's...
You're using the definition on you.
So maybe it's something to do with focus. Because things can be more or less focused. It's a continuum, isn't it? So maybe the curriculum provides the focus.
Well, absolutely.
Because certain things can be more in and out of focus and whatever. I guess what I was trying to get at, and I didn't really kind of unpack this in the post, I think I was rushing a bit, is that we've talked before about badge pathways, and so this is kind of where I was going with this. And one of the wonderful diagrams that, or one of the wonderful illustrations that Brian Mathers did, was stepping stones across a river. And yes. I feel like we often conflate the pathways with the curriculum itself. So we say, this is the end point of the curriculum, because this is what we've demarcated as being a flourishing person at Arundel School or whatever it's going to be, and this is what excellence looks like. And instead of saying there's many ways of getting there, or you can do these things in different orders, or you can skip a bit or whatever, we almost always provide stepping stones across the river, like you have to do this and then this and then this, and there's no way of doing other kind of that branching logic I was talking about before.
Yes, well, I think that's true. And the path, so the stepping stones across the river is possibly not a helpful analogy, because stones are put in place for a path when really there are loads of stones all over the river and you have to find your pathway across the stones. Does that make sense? Sort of thing. So that's my reaction to that.
So if we use the metaphor, as is often used, I don't know if you use this in your teaching, about algorithms being like a recipe, then with a recipe you can swap things out depending on what flavor you want things or whatever, or you can end up with things being pretty much exactly the same at the end but have taken different means to get there.
So for me, in all of this, what was in my mind when I read this post was The End of Average, the book by Todd Rose, and that we talked about a few episodes ago.
Donna Mullify recommended it, yes.
That's it. Yes, Donna did recommend it. Hello, Donna, if you're listening. And in that, it sort of says you can't teach the average. You have to teach the parameters of people, not teach, but you have to build things to the parameters of people, systems. And that people have very jagged profiles, meaning people do pursue different pathways, whether you like it or not. Everyone's pathway is kind of unique. So the question that sort of that presents itself to me is what can you write an algorithm for people, for humans? Can you do that? So my take on algorithms is, there's something that we do. I write for computers, it's a skeleton upon which a program will hang, to make sure that my thinking is correct, to start with a set of inputs and come with a certain output, and control the process that goes on in between to meet the criteria of my problem. So I'm wondering how well, so just to sort of push our analogy, as it were, how well an algorithm can describe the learning experience, whether that's that's 5 years in a secondary school, can it describe that experience, that curriculum that people have followed? Is it suitable? Or is it as an analogy, is really what we're talking about, reverse engineered. So that you get to the other end of your education and you can see how you have followed an algorithm of sorts, which is to do with your personality and your home setting and your school setting and your peer group and your classes and your teachers, and as well as the subject content and all of those things, and the things that you're good at and the things that you're bad at. And that's your own personal sort of algorithm, and we can reverse engineer that. But is it ever going to be worthwhile writing an algorithm, writing the curriculum as an algorithm, whereby you can, you know, a learner can branch off and focus on something that it is that they find really, really interesting?
Well, so this pertains to something really interesting that happened while I was away at the end of last week. Which I wasn't going to raise, but it goes directly onto what we're talking about here. So, while I was away last Thursday, my wife got in touch with me saying my son was upset because he came home with a sticker on his planner saying that his accelerated reader score was something like 1.1 to 1.6. So I don't know if you're familiar with accelerated reader. It's a thing that they do in the middle schools and high schools. Does your school do it?
Not that I'm aware of.
So it's an American program. I believe that the one part of it relates to grade one, which is basically reception, so a six-year-old, and it was saying that his reading age was of a six-year-old, which is obviously not true because he eats books for breakfast and has read, I think, almost the entire series of Diary of a Wimpy Kid in about 4 days. So his reading age is obviously above a nine-year-old. So there's obviously a problem there, and we investigated it, and they'd made a mistake. They basically hadn't done the teacher assessment part of it. So what you've got there is a proprietary algorithm, a black box, which is being applied to an individual learner. And because, you know, we as educators can see there's a problem there, we push back, and lo and behold, his reading age is above his numerical age. And they've gone back and they've looked at everyone in the whole cohort the whole year. Now, that's based on professional knowledge and, you know, parental will and investigation. But I wonder what would be the situation if you had a very complicated algorithm which was provided by a commercial company. And, you know, we talked, I think, a couple of weeks ago about people being rejected for jobs because of algorithms being applied to job applications. Well, there's a similar situation here where a faulty algorithm developed by somebody who hasn't got a background in education and which has intellectual property attached to it could lead to unforeseen consequences.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the thing about, you see, this is the thing about algorithms and computer science, is that it's your job as the programmer, to write a testing plan that will, and success criteria for the thing that accommodates all possible known outcomes of your system, to catch that sort of thing, to catch the thing that's going to go wrong. But quite clearly, the issue with algorithms is they're only as good as the person that writes them, and you know, they might not have had their coffee that morning or whatever. You know, it's you never know what's going on.
They also, and I do talk about this in the post, so I cited Khan Academy's knowledge map, which is like a constellation map. It always reminds me of Frontier Elite 2, a game I played a lot as a child, where you can kind of go around the universe and there's links between things. Mm-hmm. And the point I was trying to make there is that in things like maths and sciences and languages, there are definite stepping stones and concepts that need to be understood as building blocks. And so you can define the relationships between these pretty static, hard concepts in a way that you can't do with humanities. So it seems to me that algorithms don't deal very well with ambiguity.
Yes. And this is an interesting thing, isn't it? I'm worried. I think, so you write in your post, In order to have an algorithmic curriculum, there need to be disaggregated learning content and activities that serve as data points. Now, we know this to be true, and I think that what we're sort of tugging at the moment is the disaggregated learning content. It's the learning that is not bespoke, that is bespoke to each individual learner and their steps through each day over the time that they're within the algorithm, if you like. And so that's quite important. And there's a question, though, isn't there, about, and I think this is where everyone is sort of wrestling with the idea of assessment at the moment, trying to pull assessment apart because what is in place is unsatisfactory, and looking at how you can somehow not place value but align some kind of measurement to things that are really quite valuable that you see in the classroom as a teacher, but they don't really have a lot of place either in the room that you're in, as in the qualification that you're doing. So if I take an example, a pupil in one of my classes writing newsletters, he did an amazing job of condensing the information into a really tight couple of lines that were engaging to the reader, and there was nowhere for me to really sort of say, well, actually, that shows this amazing ability that others in the class do not have. Whereas, do you know what I mean? There was nowhere for me to, other than in the teacher assessment, I guess, which I can feed back to parents.
I think that's the thing. It becomes very reductionist. It's very instrumental to reduce everything down to this is the only. It makes everything very two dimensional.
Yes.
Because everything has to be related that way. I've got a wonderful book. I love this book. It's called The Novel Cure. It's a very thick book, and it's published. Well, the people who are behind it run courses through the School of Life, that Alain de Botton kind of project. And what it is you basically, it's got an index, and you flick to how you're feeling. So you're feeling depressed, you're feeling joyous, you're feeling reflective. And it recommends books based on how you're feeling. So it's almost like a... But it's not an algorithm, it's more of a heuristic, yeah? It's a bit fuzzy. Mm-hmm. But what it does do is it curates stuff in a way which works a bit like the human brain. So sometimes you're feeling sad, well, here's a book to wallow in, but also here's a book to make you feel better. Depends how you're feeling. And so I feel like when I'm talking about there being disaggregated learning content, I don't mean that in a, oh, learn this and then build on that and then it's very stepping stones across the river. I feel like it's more human-curated stuff. Because in my subject, history, let's say you're trying to develop historical empathy. Well, mm-hmm. What would be the building blocks for that? You'd need a range of experiences, and then you'd need some kind of formative assessment which showed how the student was developing in that regard, rather than can this person do algebra, you know?
Yeah, so it's where things aren't very binary, isn't it? So we've talked before about how the human brain doesn't align well to a computer, but people use it as an analogy all of the time. Think about the human brain as a computer, and it's not. And it's a very different thing, and the arguments that go on about this are long and ferociously fought, and from both sides. And it's quite interesting. We discussed that, I don't know, ages ago, in the summer maybe, before or whatever. Shut up, died. So what I'm wondering is this analogy, is the curriculum as an algorithm, the algorithmic curriculum, the algorithm. Dare you say
algorithm? That's the worst portmanteau I've ever heard.
Okay, how about this then? I quite like this one. The curriculum.
curriculum.
I like that. An idea that there's a rhythm to your learning. You know how there's a rhythm to all good things in life, really? There's a rhythm to your day.
Don't start snapping your fingers, that's fine.
Exactly, but if you have a rhythm to your learning, like poetry and song and and all words, you know, prose
has rhythm. Don't wear a daisy headband and long flowing skirts, no.
Never. That's not what I mean. I think things have rhythm, like, you know, the day, everything does. Jeez, my lessons have rhythm, I think.
I'm just pulling.
That's allowed. You're allowed to call me a hippie. I don't wear shoes. I guess most people do. I wrote something in Slack yesterday when we were discussing this. Is the idea of a curriculum as an algorithm beyond useful as an anchor for us to have a discussion about what we do in schools?
I think it is. And I put another link in here from April 2014 when Laura Hilliger and I were working at Mozilla, and she did this wonderful thing. You know, she has times when she just absolutely blitzes stuff. And this was a day when all the stars aligned, and she did this amazing thing based on, I think, a Google Doc spreadsheet, a bit of JavaScript. And she came up with this web literacy learning pathways based on the version of the web literacy map, which was current at that time. And it's wonderful. Basically, it's you go to a certain part of the web literacy map, and you say, what should I know to be able to get here? And the rest of it lights up depending on what you should know to be able to get to that point. And then if you've already done that, then what can I learn next? And that seems to me to be a great starting point if you did want to do a curriculum as algorithm.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I'm going to sort of... So after we've rendered the idea of curriculum as algorithm useless, this is sort of bringing to mind the idea that unless you have talented personnel in place in a school, really what a school requires is that you do scale and you do it well. You know, you do it as well as you can. Hmm. So you want, you know, you want that that guidance from centralized authorities, expertise on the subjects and how to learn the subjects to get to the level that's, you know, this up the stepping stones that are required, which is the next level of qualifications, generally speaking, in our society. But obviously we as human beings and teachers and educators know better than that. Mm-hmm. And but this is a really sort of nice idea, because the sort of structures that Laura's put in place here, you highlight something and it as what should I learn next, and it highlights things that seemingly not in a linear sequence whatsoever, but jumping around the matrix. I quite like that.
Mm. Now, the thing which made that possible, really, in terms of it being able to jump around, do all that kind of stuff, was that there was a prototype called the Weblit Mapper. And what that was, if you remember something like pinboard.in or Delicious or any kind of social bookmarking tool, it was like that, but the controlled taxonomy for tagging anything which you bookmarked to do with a web literacy curriculum, you tagged it with the competencies from the web literacy map, which meant that you had this continuous stream of activities which related to a particular part of the map.
That makes sense. So I just wanted to talk to you about the two books that you mentioned, one to wallow in your situation and one to pull you out of it, you know. And which book do you want? Well, really, the truth of the matter, you want both books and you want to sit with the choice. So you might, in the moment, want to wallow a little bit, and you open the wallowing book and you indulge yourself. But the feel-good book or whatever is just sitting there to the side of your peripheral vision, and you can pick it up at any point. And as your mind repairs from its wallowing, and you might think, okay, I'm just going to have a little look at that, and... You know, do you know what I mean? And it allows you that opportunity. So the point being is that the decision-making process, really, and this might be against the algorithm, or it might just be incredibly agile, which is, you know, something that's come into computing in the last few years, really. The idea of being able to respond to a situation, and the situation changes whilst you're in it, and you change your work accordingly. So this idea that you've got many options on offer, and you can pull out, you know, you can start with something, you can pull out of it and take a different direction. There's, um, so there was, So Amy Burville wrote a... Did you see Amy Burville's picture of a tree? She put that in Slack.
Yes, that was beautiful, wasn't it? Based on something... What was a Kant quotation from last week?
Oh, no, this is a different one. This is in response to the curriculum as algorithm thing.
Oh, well, maybe I haven't seen that.
She makes all sorts of crazy pictures. So there's... let me just put it in here. And then... I think I've got it. Is that right?
Oh, I found it now. Curiosity branch.
The curiosity branch, yes. So the idea that if you're pulling through an algorithm, your algorithm branches into a loop, as they always do. And loops are kind of different. So branch if always, if you get to this point, you'll always go this direction. Or branch if positive, or branch if zero. If you get to a certain point, so you'll have different conditions met or not met, and you want to go somewhere. And then Amy put this picture out of a tree with this sort of, what I thought looked like the monk scream kind of face on the top of the tree like a very Lord of the Rings.
Oh, this isn't it.
and its arm is reaching out from its heart area to pointing at something of great astonishment and wonder in the distance. And the idea being branching curiosity is that the learner needs to be able to pursue something that they see as worthwhile and valuable because it catches their attention or their imagination.
It's interesting. So Amy in the Slack channel, I'm sure she won't mind sharing this, and anybody can join the We Are Open Slack channel in the solidarity bit. She says, I suppose the whole deal with school is one big creative tension. How much freedom, how many constraints, and what are the best constraints that will foster the most creativity and relevance for the individual? End the quote. So I guess when I'm looking at all this kind of stuff and I think about my own formal learning experience and that of my children, obviously the time when you've got the most creative freedom is the time when you don't have to be there. So postgraduate learning, you could argue the fact that you kind of have to do an undergraduate degree these days. It's almost like the minimum entry to get a decent job. That's why I'm working so hard on the Open Badges stuff, because I think that's ridiculous. But certainly postgraduate work is the first time you really get to do anything you want and go off in any area, especially at doctoral level. So I'm just wondering at what level curriculum as algorithm applies, and at what point curriculum as heuristic applies, and
well, that's an interesting contrast, isn't it? And I think that's one of the tensions that people find in schools, is that they want the curriculum to be more heuristic younger ages, and yet society dictates that the qualification stepping stones are in place. And still, a graduate will earn more money in their lifetime than a non-graduate. So
I mean, going back to the accelerated reader thing, you know, you need a kid by 11 years old to be a fluent reader. Otherwise, they can't really do much else. Like they're all of those branches which would be open to them otherwise are, especially around stuff that they could teach themselves, You could argue that, hey, in the world of YouTube, you can teach yourself anything through video and things. Yeah, but we still live in a very tech-based society. So I feel like there's certain things that almost just need to be drilled into kids at a young age, so that they then have the basis on which they can do the branching and the serendipity and the curiosity and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's really important, isn't it? Because I think what happens is that schools enforce. Is this true? Schools enforce specifications, schemes of work onto children.
Yep.
Teachers offer something different.
Well, basically, teachers interpret the curriculum. So they're a buffer between... Which is why, if you think about it, if you sit a kid in front of a computer, they're getting... What is essentially, there's no, the reason why it's so difficult for the Department of Education or politics to interfere with education is because there's a barrier, there's a way in which it has to be translated into the classroom and when you shut the classroom door and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And the job of the market and politicians, etc., is to try and remove that barrier. So you get initiatives like the College of Teaching, which is a blatant attempt to try and get teachers to join that instead of the union, so that, you know, there's no collective bargaining
power
and stuff.
I can't hear.
All of these things trying to remove that buffer, so that you literally have got kids in front of the computer, so that there's no human interpretation of what's happened. The politician can almost reach out of the screen and tell the kid what to do, you know. Or perhaps I'm just...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think you are and you aren't. I mean, these things filter down, and take time to filter down, and or filter through the systems. But I just have this sense that, you know, I measure the quality of a teacher that I see. If I take myself away from how other people want me to measure them, and I measure them in what I think is, I judge them in what I think are the criteria of a good teacher or not, I think that comes down to the amount of serendipity or creative sort of playfulness maybe that a teacher allows the child or the children, the class, to bring into that classroom, to live in that classroom. So it's kind of, I think I do sort of see the teacher as the buffer between the curriculum and the algorithm, the sort of thing that you possibly can't, that you can't put in a flow chart or write in pseudocode. You can't branch, because the teacher is creating this sort of, I want to say the word cloud or cloudy kind of magic, so too strong a word, and going right back to the old hippie shit. but it's like, yeah, just creating a safe place.
I mean, it's like when you start teaching, isn't it? Like, there's so much of an art to teaching, like even the behavior management and the emotion of it and the social aspect and things. It's very difficult to do anything other than a very linear march to where you want to get to. Whereas I guess the longer you teach and the more, you know, when you become a parent and the more you kind of, the older you get, the more you realize that there's many and varied ways towards the same goal, or even if you want to go to a different destination. So it again, that sounds a bit airy-fairy, but it's to what extent curriculum as algorithm is a limiting thing, and to what extent it's something which is, given that we're going to always have pressure on us as educators to formalize what it is that we do, how much we push back on it and how much we take it on as a metaphor and use it for our own ends?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's interesting. I'm just thinking, every time I see a teacher that's struggling in the classroom, they're always pointing at the curriculum. They're pointing at the specification. They're pointing at the thing over there. And every time you see a teacher that's got it sorted and is comfortable with the messy parts of learning and got their class, you know, got their children inspired and motivated or whatever, engaged, is that they're not scared to, and in fact, they lead the children away from the curriculum. They point to other things from the curriculum outwards, kind of thing. You know, it's an interesting sort of, it's a very, very different vibe in the classroom, I guess.
It reminds me of something I saw a couple of years ago on Twitter. It was one of those things, like a prompt that someone had responded to, and they'd used a box and post-it note. And it said, the overall gist of it was that a job description isn't a box to be constrained within, but it's a box to stand upon. And it seems like that with the curriculum as well. Like, it's not something to hem you in. It's something to take as a baseline and stand upon. Which is difficult when you've got a lot of content.
I like that, Doug. I like that a lot. Mm. I like the idea that the curriculum is something which you all stand upon, like the classroom floor kind of thing. Yeah, I like that. And you can, from there, you can see all sorts of great stuff.
Mm. But if we are going to use the idea of an algorithm, then I would say that, first of all, like every algorithm, like Cory Doctorow talks about, etc., like, it can't be a black box. And any time, as educators, we see shiny new technology coming in from commercial providers with proprietary algorithms and IP and stuff, we need to push back on that, because that's not really what we're about as educators. We need to see what's inside there. And also, if we are responsible for any algorithms, however simple, and using Laura's great web literacy learning pathways as an example, I feel like there needs to be an element of serendipity inside there, like almost a random function or the stealth assessment where you unlock something and you weren't expecting to unlock it, or You clicked here and you didn't get the next thing you were expecting. You got something entirely different. So going back to the analogy of what book shall I read next, you didn't get something which made you sad or happy. You got something which made you confused.
Yes, and you had to kind of work your way out of it.
Yeah.
And then it's interesting, and you do increase and decrease your randomized factors according to some method of assessment, and assessment becomes a whole different... I mean, that's another huge conversation that maybe you should focus on one tired. Interesting. Good.
Good stuff. Okay.
Enjoyable. I like that. That was fun.
Mm. Okay, well, perhaps we'll come back to that, because I feel like we haven't quite said everything we want to say with that, but I think we'll leave it there. I've stuck some things in the miscellaneous bit.
Yep.
Shall we have a quick look at those? Any which kind of jump out at you, or are you happy to go through them?
Let's go in order. I know some and not others. So
So very quickly, the Pew Internet Center for Public Research, I think they're known as, they've published a report, which I found via Ian O'Byrne. Hi, Ian, if you're listening. Something's called Digital Readiness Gaps. And as people like Pew often do, they've taken a large sample and they have put them into groups, which they, in this particular one, they say that there's five groups along a spectrum from least ready to most ready in terms of digital readiness. So there's the unprepared, traditional learners, the reluctant, cautious clickers, I love that one, and the digitally ready. And they find that, unsurprisingly, the ones who are digitally ready, which are 17% of the US adults they surveyed, were in higher income groups, higher education level, and in their 30s and 40s.
To whom the world belongs, I guess.
Mm. And as always happens, you know, the ones who are shown as being on, like on a, it's not really deprivation index, on a, if you've got a spectrum where one side is good and the other side is bad, guess what? The side that's bad tracks exactly with levels of deprivation and exclusion and minorities, and that's exactly the case here as well. So a good example to show, I know it's US-based and they have a different society to us, but a good example to show how technology is not neutral and that society is stratified instruction in a certain way to exclude particular people.
Yes, I think this is interesting. So just for the reference of the listener, should anyone be listening, Doug just cut out for about 20 seconds on me there, but I'm living on boarding house Wi-Fi at the moment because BT are incompetent and can't get a line installed in my flat. But I'm assuming that they'll have heard of everything.
It was Radio Gold, basically, Di.
Okay, Radio Gold, and I missed it. That's the deal.
You have to listen back. but I think I've said all I want to say about that. It's worth exploring, especially if you're based in the US. It's possibly a good thing to point towards if you want to do anything which works with people to improve kind of digital readiness, digital capability, digital literacy. So there's that. The next one is written by Martin Weller, who is a professor of education at the Open University and based in Cardiff. And he's called this Open Education and the Unenlightenment. And he's talking about the Enlightenment and what that stood for. And he says, quote, "The Unenlightenment sees a reversal of this basic principle, willful avoidance of knowledge. During the Brexit campaign, we saw Michael Gove proudly declare that he didn't listen to experts. Brexit may be the most complex political task currently underway anywhere in the world. I don't begin to understand the legislative, trading, social implications of realizing it. Whatever your own view on the vote, it is surely bizarre that experts should be deliberately excluded by some from commenting on a task of such complexity. And with Donald Trump, we repeatedly see him, his team, and his supporters dismiss facts and experts. This is not incidental, it is core to his appeal." And so Martin's just talking about the kind of backlash to the Enlightenment and how open education fits into all of this in terms of OERs and MOOCs and the resources that we supply. And I guess his argument is that you can't just focus on the supply side. You can't say, here's loads of information and here's loads of facts proving that I'm right, because facts don't change people's mind.
Yes, it's quite interesting, isn't it? People make their decisions based on other rudimentary ideas that they have and or something that they've heard or seen, and it's essentially ruling through clickbait is what it becomes, I think. And you can't force people to listen to the truth. They're not interested in some cases, you know.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, he's talking about academics getting out their ivory towers and things, but people respond to incentives. And if you're disenfranchised, I tell you an interesting statistic that I saw this week, and I haven't verified it, so take this with a pinch of salt. The top 8 teams in the Premier League were areas that all voted Remain, and the bottom 4 were the ones that voted most strongly to leave.
Wow.
I don't know what that means, but what I would say is that those who voted to leave the EU, from what I've read, were the ones who felt like the current system wasn't serving them and they might as well do something radically different. Seems the same with Donald Trump. And in terms of people responding to incentives, that was a disincentive for them to maintain the status quo. And in terms of academics, their incentive is to publish in high status peer-reviewed journals, and that just perpetuates the separation of their work, which proves or disproves things about the world, from the mass of humanity. And open education is kind of a bridge between that, in terms of opening up resources, open up lines of communication, but just doing that doesn't change people's minds. And I think it's a pretty nuanced post. It's good stuff.
Mm. I saw an interesting stat pitched out today, and I don't have it, and I can't find it because I can't remember what it was. But it was about Oxford academics, and 40% of them are depressed.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, which I thought was quite an interesting thing. So I've just typed that in, and there's dealing with Oxford and depression, May 2016, October 2010 in the student room. Is everyone at Oxford depressed? My daughter's just about to start at Oxford, so I'm slightly concerned.
It's totally random, but linked to my mind, I have listened to about half of Adam Buxton interviewing Michael Palin on his podcast.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which is fascinating. And Michael Palin talks about the fact that him and, Terry Jones, I think, went to Oxford. The rest of them went to Cambridge.
That's
and
right.
That him and Terry were very much avid diarists and reflectors on life, whereas the Cambridge guys were very much kind of like getting on and making progress in life kind of people. And I wondered whether that was a product of the environment they had in their formative years at university, or whether that was something which was almost selected. It's a small sample size, but it just made me think from what you've just said there.
Well, I think there's something certainly worth unpacking, this whole idea of, certainly in my school, you know, pitching for Oxbridge, it's not the Holy Grail, but it's pretty close. Pupils, and maybe it's not what we think it is. That's always an interesting thing to reflect.
Well, talking about mental health, this is on Upworthy, which is, you know, manufactured clickbait, but it certainly caught my eye. The title is, "This school replaced detention with meditation. The results are stunning."
Yeah, now this is. So anybody who knows me probably knows that I love this. and we just, you know, so as soon as I saw this as clickbait, it got my attention because it just kind of made so much sense. So I started analyzing it. So this article is saying that these children, when they get into trouble, they go into meditation class rather than into detention, as it were, and have to concentrate on their breathing and are recentering themselves, which allows them to be more mindful and see the world in a different way, probably more empathic, I'd imagine. And that's all that. So then I started thinking about, okay, so if I did this with very knowing teenagers, not primary school children, which is what this article is about, how would that work? You know, you get people going, oh, you mean I can be really badly behaved and then I can go and sit and be quiet in a classroom where no one's going to tell me off and stuff?
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? And it's just, But at its essence, and as you find with a lot of education, is when you're talking about younger pupils, they're far much more cooperative and receptive to fabulous ideas than the older pupils, who are more jaded and cynical, possibly, or going through stages of that kind of behavior. And that's kind of what I thought about that.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you were school and you literally went, right, as of next week, we're getting rid of detentions and everyone's going to do meditation, it just wouldn't work, because it's the culture within all of this, you know, within which it fits. And it seems like school's gone into partnership with the Holistic Life Foundation, which is a local non-profit. As you said, it's a lot easier to do with younger kids because they don't know any difference and they're not as sneaky and crafty. I mean, there's a lot to kind of push back on, but I just thought it was a great idea.
Well, as a principle, I mean, we've talked about this before, the idea of telling children off and shouting at children is just really quite useless. So even if it works, it's useless, and it completely reinforces the wrong thing to the person who's done the wrong thing, as to what their behavior A warrants, and B what the consequences of that behavior are, kind of thing, because it just makes them feel scared and ashamed or humiliated in some way or whatever. It doesn't really make them understand what it is that they've done wrong, or indeed be empathic towards the person that they did something wrong to, and be that the teacher or another member of a class or school or whatever. So to me, it certainly opens up the idea of what we should be looking at, and the sort of brave risks that some schools maybe would benefit from taking, especially if they're having issues with behavior. But
these, I mean, it's a perfect example of not, you want to deal with the causes rather than the symptoms. Like when we have multiple conversations about technology, it's never really about the technology. It's about the culture within which it is based. So same with the meditation kind of thing. What are the principles which are shaping your organization? And one of the biggest things I learned at Mozilla is that an organization which is based on principles, and like a mission and a manifesto. If you've got a mission in your manifesto, even if it's for a for-profit organization or education institution, if you've got a mission and a manifesto, you know what's in and out of scope, and you can fit everything in based on everyone being aligned towards the mission. And if people start acting in a way which isn't cognizant with the mission and the manifesto and things, then you've got a reason to move those people on rather than tolerating them.
Yes, that's right. I think it's interesting. It can all be boiled down to quite simple things, but I think what you said is good. Right. Very good. Meditate, everyone.
Yeah, next one's actually another mental health one. It's in The Guardian. It's Young Britons Living in Suspended Adulthood, research finds. The subtitle is Significant Numbers of Under 30s Lack Self-Confidence and Are at Risk of Mental Health Problems, with Women Worst Affected, says report.
Okay, let me just be a little bit skeptical, not read this. Life begins at 40, so I've
well, life hasn't started for me yet then, okay.
No, indeed, you just hang on there. But I remember speaking to relatives of mine, a generation above, and they, when they look back on their lives, they say that the best time in their lives was their 30s, when their children were young, and they didn't really give a hoot what anyone thought of them in the world. They just did what they did, and they'd worked out what they were going to do and how they were raising their children, and they were in their sort of tight family unit, and that was probably the best time. And then they turned 40 and they have to deal with some things, and but that's also a very, very pleasurable time, because you start to reclaim self back if you are a parent, and that's your sort of age bracket of that happening, or your time frame. I don't know. But it's the whole mental health epidemic. Is that the right word? It's kind of doing my head in a little way. I can't really get my head around it. I tell you what, we've just implemented at our school, and I'm sure other schools have done the same, a big concussion program. So we play a lot of rugby, you know, it's sort of and other sport, hockey as well, and where the, you know, they're non contact sports, or hockey, but people seem to get injured quite a lot, but we now have a very strict thing of concussion, and that children are not allowed to play any sport for a 3-week period, I think it is. And then after that, they are slowly introduced back into lessons, and they're slowly introduced back into activity and then sport, ultimately through, you know, a staggered program of reintroduction. And this is all very well documented now, so that teachers can be aware of the children that have suffered from concussion, and how it might affect their behavior, and all of that. And ever since that's happened, I've just become increasingly aware of children, of like there being so many children with concussion, and the different behaviors that have been exhibited because of it, which are a bit sort of weird, like talking to themselves when they wouldn't normally, in a kind of sort of erratic way, you know, not something in line with their character and things like that. I'm sure I've been concussed several times in my life, and I've never had any treatment for it or staggered anything, and or anyone looking after me, kind of thing, looking out for me, I guess, through the time of concussion. I don't know. It's a bit weird. And there's someone put something in Slack earlier about language just before the podcast started, and you replied. It was the words hurt people these days. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Greg put in about, yeah. What was your point about concussion? Sorry, what was your point?
It's that the fact that it has now become a very regulated system of dealing with concussion seems
right, so Greg put into Slack. He prefaced this by saying it was wildly inappropriate, but made him laugh. He said that, and it's something which he's taken from Facebook. It's like an image. It says, 1944, 18-year-old stormed the beach of Normandy into almost certain death. 2016, 18-year-olds need a safe place because words hurt their feelings. And my response was, words have always hurt feelings, just that we're a bit more progressive these days.
Damn right.
Have you listened to the Invisibilia episode about the oil rig?
I have not, no. Tell me about
it. I mean, I won't spoil it for you. I'll put the link into the show notes. Some of the Invisibilia episodes I've listened to so far are some of the best stories I have ever heard in my life.
Really? Strong praise.
No, seriously. I mean, they're about some about mental health, some about... there's a lot of them about mental health. It's like the hidden side of everything. So one of the ones I was just listening to was about a place in Belgium where it's the normal thing, and it was based on hundreds of years ago where the saint of the town was supposed to be the saint of the mentally ill. And so it's the normal thing, has been happening for generations, that normal people like you and I will take someone who's mentally ill into their home, and just the fact that they don't judge them, they just accept them, makes their mental illness like 90% better. But this particular one on the oil rig was about, just trying to say it in a way which won't spoil it, very macho men and a culture where there were lots of accidents, people are killed all the time, etc. And the way in which they basically got them to talk about their feelings and how it completely changed their lives, number of accidents and deaths went to like zero. Because people are looking out for each other, change the culture. And so I find, I know Greg's just being funny and things, and so he's not trying to be offensive and he can believe what he wants, but I find that kind of thing of like, hey, we used to send kids off to war to be bullet stoppers, and now it's not okay to hurt their feelings. I feel like that's us making progress.
Yes, you see, this is the thing I was going to say in this as well. So as I have an awareness of growing up, born in the beginning of the 70s, 80s, 90s. In my awareness of growing up is that I was presented with a culture of very dissatisfied and people living in an unequal society. And through that, I'm going to reference big headliners of misogyny and sexism, racism, homophobia and class, I guess, as well, and as well as economic divides, I guess, and all of these things. The developments in the world, I think, are happening, and people like I'm a big fan of political correctness, for example, and because it's there for a reason, and these things have emerged with purpose to look after different members of society who are not me necessarily, but army at the same time, kind of thing. That's, you know, so the structures that are put in place are things that help me to treat other people in the society in which I live well.
We can talk about this for ages. I mean, the way that I would sum that up is that when you're privileged, when you get to a level of privilege, you get to a level where you can't see your own privilege anymore. And I feel like that now when I live in Morpeth, which is a lovely place. I mean, it's not as nice as Jersey, which is definitely the playground of the rich and famous, but it's very middle class. Everyone's doing very well as far as I can see. And had I grown up here, I would have literally no idea of how privileged my life was. But having grown up in a, you know, very rough area, you know, all of the things, apart from London, the most deprived areas, as you know, Ty, recognizing that I'm living a privileged life. And if you don't know what you don't know, and I feel like it's the same thing about mental health, as someone who's dealt with all this stuff, as someone who has to have a light during the winter months, all this kind of stuff, just realizing that people, you don't know what you don't know. So, yeah.
I think, I mean, that's very much the case, and it's something you can't help but face very much in London. So I lived in London for 20 years and lived in different areas, and was very conscious when I lived in areas that sort of economically excluded the general populace of London. And I lived in areas that were very poor and very dangerous and would be seen as sort of high risk areas. They weren't very dangerous. I've never lived anywhere that I felt threatened, even in riots in Brixton or whatever. So I think it is the case of that I'm very conscious, especially where I live now in Arundel. I'm very conscious of the economic segregation of Arundel into its bubble from a lot of what society is, really, that kind of thing.
Anyway, last link, which is linked to all this, is grammar schools and social mobility. So this is a report by a think tank. You know, there's many different think tanks. This one's the Education Policy Institute. And what they've done is they've looked at the government's idea for grammar schools, and they've said that even on the government's own terms, this isn't a good idea. So just before we talk about this, it's worth mentioning, as Oliver Quinlan says, he calls it dead cat politics, by which he means there's an Australian saying of you're having a conversation, another person says, "Yeah, mate, but there's a dead cat on the table. We need to talk about that dead cat." Like, there's literally, it slapped a dead cat on the table to stop you talking about the thing you're talking about. And Oliver's point, I guess, is that the grammar school thing might be a red herring to stop us talking about Brexit.
Yes, I'm not sure that second bit's true necessarily. I think the grammar school thing is coming. It's been on the agenda for a long time. It's the idea that we go back to a modern school system. So for those that aren't sure, grammar schools are for the more academically able, as are judged by an exam at the age of 11. And then the modern schools would do more vocational curriculum, a different kind of algorithm, if you like. And so the current government are looking at bringing grammar schools back in. Kind of big style, really. But if you actually go back to all of the research that's ever been done about the impact of grammar schools, it's all rubbish.
Mm. And we, you know, a lot of it comes from anecdotes and confirmation bias by the small number of people who've done very well, including, for example, Theresa May. So, oh, look at this person who came from a disadvantaged background and has risen to the top. Yes, but you don't see the trail littered with people who didn't make it. You know, it's not like when I talk to people who are self-taught programmers, they say, well, how hard can it be? Like, I taught myself. But then you don't see the thousands of people who gave up along the way.
No, that's it.
So this thing has six key findings, this Education Policy Institute report, and the report's worth looking at. I kind of scanned it and looked at some of the graphs and things. Shall we go through these one by one? I'll do the first one. Number one, once prior attainment and pupil background is taken into consideration, we find no overall attainment impact of grammar schools, either positive or negative.
no overall attainment impact of grammar scores, positive or negative. Okay, so that basically is indifferent. Number two, pupils who are eligible for free school meals, a proxy for disadvantage, are underrepresented in grammar schools, citing that only 2.5% of grammar school pupils are entitled to free school meals, compared with a national average of 15.2% in all state-funded secondaries.
Number three, we do not find a significant positive impact on social mobility, which is the main point. The gap between children on free school meals, attaining 5 A-star to Cs in GCSEs, including English and Maths, and all other children, is actually wider in selective areas than in non-selective areas, at around 34.1% compared with 27.8%. And they go into some of the reasons for that.
Number four, an expansion of grammar schools in areas which already have a large number of selective schools could lead to lower gains for grammar school pupils and small attainment losses for those not attending selective schools, losses which will be greatest amongst poor children.
Number five, if you compare high attaining pupils in grammar schools with similar pupils who attend high quality non-selective schools, there are 5 times as many high quality non-selective schools as there are grammar schools.
It's a big point there. Mm. Number six, other interventions to raise school standards and attainment have proven to be more effective than grammar schools in raising the attainment of disadvantaged pupils. The Labour-sponsored Academies program has had a more positive impact on the attainment of disadvantaged pupils compared with the present grammar school system.
And it goes on to talk about how Education Policy Institute has commissioned research from the LSE, and this will be where more right-wing politicians, etc., would say, well, hey, this is a left-wing think tank, and la-da-da-da. But there's a lot of nuance in here. And what you've got, and it goes back to a point we made earlier, is that you can't change people's minds by showing them graphs and pointing to evidence when they're doing the equivalent of Donald Trump and talking about stories and anecdotes.
So I know people personally who have had a really good... who went to grammar schools and has done really well. And they come from very poor families and gone on and achieved great things through their education. And they've done that through grammar schools. But what's to say these people would not have done so through a well-run state?
Well, the thing, I mean, going back to Oliver again, Oliver's been saying some very sensible things on this. I quoted him in my newsletter, and I'll not be able to find it quick enough now, but his basic point was that We talk about meritocracy, and we don't really examine how people are using the word meritocracy. And the way that Theresa May seems to be using it is that a meritocracy means that some people deserve to do well in society and some people don't. So, hey, if you're a bright, poor child, then you deserve society to look after you. But if you're a less bright, poor child, then you should just languish.
Yes, and this is where it all... So really what the Conservative government is saying is, let us provide the privileged with a way to maintain their privilege.
Absolutely. I mean, going back to Plato, talked about people, people have different types of metal in their soul. I think he talked about people have bronze in their soul and gold in their soul or silver, whatever. I remember reading that, thinking, really? And then being a bit older, especially as a parent, thinking, that's a bit of a scary view of society. Like, there's fixed things, and you educate people based on, a bit like Brave New World with alpha, betas, and gammas. Like, people have fixed destinations from a very young age. And this is really what the Conservative government are talking about with grammar schools. And so... I don't really know what would be the equivalent anecdote to fire back at them. Because even my dad, I remember going back to County Durham to see the place where he grew up, which is still a really desolate place, and pointing out where he used to kick around the tin can because another football on the back of the terraced house where he lived and his dad was doing... Anyway, so he managed to get into... I think he failed the 11 plus... but then managed to get into the grammar school after a test a year later. and then did well for himself, you know, and in terms of where he'd come from. And so that you might think, well, that's a good example of grammar schools. Like, if he'd stayed the second one, then he wouldn't have done so well. But instead of talking about the very, you know, the 1% of individuals who've done well, we should be talking about society rather than just everything being about competition all the time.
We damn well should, and we don't, do we? It's quite interesting, and people are guilty of this. I'm guilty of this in my own life, and it's focusing on these big achievements and people making it, and, you know, you celebrate these big things, but actually all that's really happening is the people who achieve the big things, you can kind of, like, you don't have to worry about them so much, and really your work should thereafter be about the ones who aren't doing so well or finding it more difficult to cope with the set of cards that have been dealt.
We could talk about this for a long time, but to me it's the difference between elite performance and being elitist. But let's leave it there for now. I've really enjoyed this evening's discussion. I thought that stuff on curriculum's algorithm should hopefully get people thinking. If you're listening to this and you've got a response, we'd love to read some blog posts if you're interested in this. On social networks, etc. Tell us what you think, if you've got some responses to that, and also on anything that we've talked about today based on privacy, the pedagogy of Google Classroom, the algorithmic heuristic stuff, or any of the links that we've talked about at the end. And almost everything we've talked about will be in the show notes on our newly redesigned website at tidepodcast.org.
I'd just like to say, if you heard tin crashing in the middle of that, that's because my MacBook's power lead was wrapped around something and it fell over. And then if you heard lots of boys crashing and banging around, that's because I live with 62 teenagers.
Not all yours.
They're not all mine, no, and their prep time finished at 9 o'clock.
Finally, then, what are you up to this week, Di?
This week, I am planning different things. So I'm going to launch a couple of things. Teacher Tech Time at my school, which is going to be a drop-in session where I buy people a pint and they bring their tech woes to me and I sort them out, or help them sort them out. I'm not sure how well that's going to go or just how much free beer people are going to come for.
I'm going to say it's like a genius bar but lubricated with alcohol.
That's pretty much the deal. And then I've been writing this document, which I shared with you before we recorded this, called the Digital Learning Party, it's called, and it's like a working party of teachers that want to dig their tech and get into it. And I've been working on that. It's kind of sort of funny.
So it's not a political party, it's more like a rave.
It's more like a rave. That's the idea. So it's all about having fun and people who want to take risks in their classroom and play with the tech, and I'll just make sure that the tech works and help them out. But really, really what I'm trying to do is lubricate their journey and make it possible.
Digital Learning Party, lubricating your journey.
I don't think I'll put that strap.
I don't think that should be the subtitle.
So, and just teaching, reports are coming, and all of that, halfway through the first half term. So there we go.
Good stuff.
How about yourself? What are you up to?
So it's Tuesday night. Yesterday, we did some stuff with We Are Open. I had a conversation with a client who I'm going to start doing some work with, it's Open Badge Factory, so they're another badge system provider, so I do some workshops with them. And then I had my first Scouts Executive Committee meeting, so I'm now on the Executive Committee for the local Scouts, of which my son is a part, which was instructive in the art of how to make a meeting that should have lasted about 45 minutes last 2 hours. But it was good fun, and there were lots of biscuits. And then today, I really haven't been very motivated, but I have managed to do some just admin-y stuff that I needed to do and talk to Sunderland a bit more about the Thinkathon we're going to be running for them, about their pilot, which is going to be about badges and digital learning and stuff. Tomorrow, I'm doing my presentation for Thursday, which I'll talk about in a moment, watching my daughter's Harvest Festival and basically not having much time to do any work because my wife's at school and I've got some stuff to do. Thursday I'm in Glasgow doing a keynote at a badge maker launch for Snook, who got some UFI funding. Friday is my Doug day, and I am going to be driving over to Lake District, and I'm going up Helvellyn and then spending Saturday up mountains as well. So I get two quality mountain days in as part of my build-up to my mountain leader course.
All right, that'll be fun. Get up on the mountains.
Mm. So plenty of stuff to do, and still have some capacity if people are interested. Up until Christmas, I am filling up in terms of new clients and old clients bringing things back to me. It takes a month to kind of spin these things up after everyone's been away. But yeah, if anyone's listening and needs my help, just interested in what I'm up to, then let me know.
Cool. Right, excellent. So if you've got this far, well done. Congratulations to you. So one thing you've achieved this week is listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next time.
I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.